Good morning. This is the Finance Administration Committee, and I want to call the meeting to order. The agenda before us are two items. The first item, we're going to take the information item first and the 7,000 series second, unless there are objections from members of the committee here.
Great.
Okay?
Great.
Thank you very much. Ms. Kissel, you are going to begin with an introduction. Okay.
Great. Thank you. The information item that we're actually going to talk about today will be a review of the Metro Access policy with relation to, in context to, the budget for FY 2011. Jack Weiner is here, who will be presenting the presentation, and I will send it over to him.
Thank you.
Oh, Solène. Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. Thank you for that distinction. Solène?
Good morning. we begin the slide presentation by basically showing who we serve and where they're located throughout our service area. This pie chart is a distribution of passengers transported by jurisdiction during fiscal year 2009, and this was 2.1 million passengers, and at the close of FY09, we had about 25,500 registered Metro Access customers. And the next slide goes over our current service levels. Right now, our FY10 ridership through January is 1.36 million passengers, and we are on track to finish at or potentially above our projected ridership for FY10. The month of March is historically a very high ridership month for us, so we'll know a little bit more by the end of this month whether our projections will be met or surpassed. We are receiving approximately 10,000 reservations daily, and our weekday ridership continues to ramp up and is currently averaging 7,700. And our weekend ridership, although significantly lower, is tending to increase as well, averaging about 2,900. And our annual ridership is projected to increase to 3.6 million passengers by 2014, which will be a 50% growth over this fiscal year. 1,282 registered customers took a total of 61,268 trips, or 3.4% of our total trips in FY 2009 outside of the three-quarter mile ADA corridor. And the next slide goes into more detail in how our current Metro Access service differs from ADA requirements and also differs from other specialized transportation services. You'll see that obviously the ADA requires three-quarter of a mile radius around all fixed route lines and a curb-to-curb minimum. Metro Access, of course, has been door-to-door for almost the past 2 years, and we exceed the three-quarter mile corridor around fixed route quite dramatically. In fact, we have 583 square miles beyond the three-quarter mile corridor that we serve. And, of course, with specialized transportation services that are not ADA paratransit, they're not linked to fixed route, and they're very much free to model their service as appropriate for their customers, their service design, and the finances available to them. The response time required under the ADA is, of course, that customers be able to book trips 24 hours before. Our customers may, of course, do that. They also may book up to 7 days in advance if it suits their needs. And other specialized transportation services, again, can set their own limits, and they might require many days in advance, or then they also do same-day service. Fares can be up to twice the comparable fixed-route fare, which is something that the board is obviously considering. Currently, our fare is a flat fare of $2.50, and we do have nominal supplemental fares that we're charging for going beyond the three-quarter-mile corridor. And again, other specialized transportation services, as is the theme here, can do what they need to based on budget and the design of their service. Currently, Metro Access operates 24/7. This is obviously beyond all other public transportation options in the region. So that is a major variation from what the ADA requirement is, which is the same days and hours of fixed route. And of course, we may not have any denials of service, and we must maintain on-time performance standards. And in fact, it's worth mentioning that the ADA class action settlement under which Metro Access currently operates and will continue to operate until the beginning of July 2011 specifically dictates that the contract standards that we have for on-time performance as well as other performance measures constitute compliance with the ADA as far as that class action group is concerned, and therefore our contract standards have an even higher importance in this period of time, because if we drop below them for a notable period of time, we are considered to be in violation of the ADA by the group that brought the settlement. Moving on to the next slide, you'll see that we've got a distribution map of Metro Access customers as of January 2010. And we go over a few of the factors that are contributing to our current growth. There's improved service quality and on-time performance. We, of course, did successfully implement door-to-door service, which has been very popular and has been very useful in the sort of service area in which we all live and work. We have a relatively low fare structure as it relates to other paratransit options for fare. And Metro Access does exceed the ADA minimum standards. Economic conditions are also forcing local jurisdictions and social service agencies to curtail specialized service. So bit by bit, more and more customers are being referred to Metro Access and are having to apply for our services if they were not already registered. The next slide further demonstrates this shift that I was describing of passengers from jurisdictional and human service agency transportation options as well as Medicaid options. You'll see on the first chart on this slide, over a five-year period, the overall specialized transportation increase of about 20% was within the norm. However, the jurisdictional and human services transportation decreased significantly at 20%, while Metro Access went up 77%, and Medicaid also increased significantly at 52%.
So,
yes.
So this shows the shift of local, jurisdictional, and other services that reduce their participation, and where that ridership of Metro Access.
That is correct. Yes, yes. And Medicaid. Medicaid has taken on a share of that, but then both Medicaid and the jurisdictional providers have also shifted people over to Metro Access.
And could I ask, what's the nature of the Medicaid service?
The nature of the Medicaid service is typically, it's very specifically defined, so it's for medical purposes, and the funding that is provided to pay for those trips does tie to the trip purpose, whereas, of course, Metro Access, as the ADA paratransit provider, cannot request or provide service based on trip purpose. All trips are equal.
How is the Medicaid service provided? What's the
Medicaid service is provided differently in different jurisdictions, but very often by a broker that is, or an independent contractor brought in to provide that service for the jurisdiction, and then the funding that customers have ties directly to the trips that they book through that service for medical purposes.
What is that? Just from my, I wasn't familiar with it, the NEMT?
That stands for non-emergency medical transport, which is basically the classification.
To the doctor visits or clinic,
yes,
right?
Yeah. And one thing that should be noted, especially with the way Medicaid transport is administered, in most cases, the recipient for Medicaid funds are the states, and in the district, there's an exception, obviously. Most of the time, it's provided by brokers, and the contracts are performed on what's called a capitated rate, which means they pay a set amount of money based on the number of registered customers, regardless of how often they travel. So as these growth shifts that you see here because of the smaller agencies and human service agencies curtailing, most of the shift goes to either Metro Access or Medicaid right away. Right. When Medicaid reaches its limit, when the brokers no longer can survive financially by the capitated rate, then we start seeing a shift into public transit ADA. And that's what we've seen over the last several years, and it's significant.
And something that I neglected to mention on the last slide, but I did want to make very clear, is that Metro Access is the only transportation service in this metropolitan region that is required to provide ADA paratransit. So all other paratransit and specialized transportation services in the region can modify their service hours, service area, and trip purpose, as necessary.
Yeah, just for background, other jurisdictions in the region do provide fixed route transit service, but you're saying they don't have the ADA obligation?
Right, because Metro took it on for the region.
Took it on for the region on their behalf.
Correct.
Okay.
So the other, in fact, the other paratransit operations as well do not have to work under ADA guidelines, although some of them do to a large degree, but nobody has to.
Thank you. I'm looking at this map, and it reinforces pretty much what we already knew in terms of the statistics. But I'm looking at the heavy concentration in Prince George's County, the heavy usage. Is that, can you elaborate on that?
Yes. Basically, you'll see, the areas where we have a higher density of usage do tend to be areas where there are fewer alternative transportation options, whether it be that people just live further from fixed route than is convenient for them, or there are fewer specialized transportation service options that they might choose over and above Metro Access. Let me know what else you would like to know.
I guess I know that there's other transportation, but it may not be, I don't know, it may not be specialized is what you're saying.
Right, right. And in terms of people who are outside of the ADA corridor in Prince George's County, what we did do when we were looking at the 1,282 individuals who traveled outside of the corridor during fiscal year 2009, is we looked at how many of those trips and approximately how many people were allocated to different jurisdictions. So it is true that there are about 41,000 trips that were taken by Prince George's County residents, but that was by a total of approximately 700 registered customers. Which is not, of course, to be ignored. Every customer affected by any changes that we consider and that the board considers is important. But I also think that it's always important to look at the number of customers versus the number of trips, because it does tell a different story than even we were expecting when we began pulling the data.
If we go to page 17 in the appendix, mm-hmm. where we have the chart of really the distribution of those trips, which I think is very important to the committee in terms of where in the, what's the number in the jurisdictions, because I think that's really also a really graphic piece that
yes.
describes that. That's right, beyond three-quarter mile. Okay, you may go ahead, please.
Okay.
And we can move through these
quickly. Sure. The next slide on national context, that's slide five, just shows the overall growth in paratransit trips on a national scale from 96 through 2008. And this is very much in line with the sort of growth we're seeing here. And we also see the operating costs per passenger trip for the 50 largest transit agencies for bus service versus demand response service. The next slide shows the Metro Access ridership and budget, again, reflecting what we saw on the national scale. And the following slide shows that our cost per passenger for one-way trip is really stabilizing within what the national averages have been. And the national growth curve, I lost my note on that one, but basically the operational efficiencies have kept our cost per trip pretty level over the last few years. The next slide moves on to some of our current growth management initiatives. This one focuses on eligibility. A staff of specialists is now performing functional assessments in-house here in the Jackson Graham building and providing customers with greater independence based on individual abilities to use accessible fixed route. Ultimately, we'll be moving towards conditional eligibility, and the Accessibility Advisory Committee is going to be vetting that and giving us feedback in April as we move towards that. The workload currently exceeds the capacity with over 1,000 applications being received monthly, and with no additional room for growth, we're looking for additional funding that could provide greater benefit to our customers and maximize our use of resources by extending work hours into the evenings and Saturdays, shortening wait times, and providing additional staff to meet with the increasing volume. And also this helps route customers who are interested to travel training options so that they can better familiarize themselves with the more independent option of using fixed route if it's appropriate to their needs.
Did you have a question? Yes, go ahead.
Okay.
Mr. Benjamin has a question.
Conditional eligibility seems to me to be one of the key issues relative to our long-term cost growth.
Yes.
And you were a little bit vague, first of all, on timing, and second of all, on number of people who are likely to be affected by that. Can you give us a little bit more information? And for most of the people here, you may want to also say what conditional eligibility actually means as we implement it.
Okay. Previously, Metro Access eligibility has been you either are or you are not eligible. And eligibility is determined based on an individual with a qualifying disability's functional ability to use fixed route transportation. If they are unable to use it, they would be qualified for Metro Access. Conditional eligibility, which is allowed for under the ADA and we are moving towards, basically looks at the situation where some customers have the ability to use fixed route some of the time. That might be based on their specific disability. That might be based on weather conditions. That might be based on environmental factors. So through the eligibility process, we can determine if they are, in fact, conditionally eligible. Therefore, they can use Metro Access for the trips that they require it for and use fixed route transportation for other trips. In terms of the timing on that, the goal at this point would be to begin that at the start of the next fiscal year. And we are working with the committee, as I said, in April to get their feedback to the preliminary outline of how this would be put into place. But that is the timeline under which we're working. It is, in fact, key to our cost savings and our growth management in the future. It's truly very difficult to predict how many people may be conditionally eligible, because since we have not used this process before, we don't have numbers on that. We do, however, and the next slide goes a little bit into Metro's free ride program, which has been permitting for a number of years customers who are Metro Access eligible to use fixed route for free. We do know that many customers have self-selected to use fixed route over the last number of years, and we imagine that even more of our customers would very likely be conditionally eligible. However, since the free ride program has not tracked people on an individual basis, we can only talk about total trips versus number of registered customers who may have this type of eligibility shift.
Madam Chair, may I follow up just to get a couple of those points? So my understanding then is that if I were having difficulty, say, using bus, but I could use rail, I could get conditional eligibility that would say I'll get picked up by a paratransit vehicle, but instead of taking it to my destination or taking me to my destination, it'll take me to the closest rail station.
Absolutely. And another key of conditional eligibility is helping us establish in the future a feeder service based on areas that we've identified. There are many people with conditional eligibility living relatively close to rail service, for instance. So perhaps there are many of your neighbors have the same situation as you. It's very difficult for them to utilize bus service, but rail is something that they can do. So perhaps Metro Access would have not just individual trips, but a feeder service bringing people to rail on a consistent basis at rush hour, you know, a.m. and p.m.
So once we start implementing this, and you're saying our goal is the beginning of the next fiscal year, would every new person coming in automatically be evaluated for conditional eligibility?
Yes, we would keep with the same schedule. We wouldn't be recertifying people sooner, but based on their current recertification schedule, they would be assessed for conditional eligibility, full eligibility, or denial of eligibility.
Okay, so what you're saying is if I'm brand new and I've never been in the system, I'll automatically go to that as soon as we start.
That is correct.
And everybody else, when they get to their recertification, so you have to do a recertification how often?
Currently, it's every 3 years. Our customers and our advisory group have been advocating for some changes in that, so that'll be one of the things that is being discussed. I know people with permanent disabilities have many times been asking for permanent eligibility. Although we are not entertaining the idea of a permanent eligibility, if somebody has a consistent and unchanging diagnosis, or if it is changing, it's progressing instead of getting better or being intermittent, we are looking at a longer term of eligibility and not having to reproduce medical documentation of something that is very stagnant and has been in existence for most of their lives. So we're simplifying the process in a lot of ways. But the current answer is 3 years, but I think that we'll be moving that out a little bit if that's the feedback we get.
Well, except that if, in fact, we're moving towards conditional eligibility, I would hope we would do that as quickly as possible in recertification and then implement perhaps the delay or the longer time periods. And
duly noted.
I understand other transit agencies throughout the country have adopted this approach.
Mm-hmm.
Has there been any data on how that has affected the number of people who get full utilization of paratransit versus partial?
I do not have that data here with me today. I can absolutely try to come back to the board with additional information. I have heard anecdotally that it has had a noticeable effect, not just in the number of people who have full eligibility, but also the number of people who apply, because bit by bit customers are becoming more aware of what paratransit is designed to do and was intended to do and are choosing to not apply because they actually can use fixed route transportation. Not all of our customers, obviously, but some people make that choice.
Okay, so this is really a very important tool, and you're saying this doesn't require board consideration. You're going ahead and doing it anyway.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Mr. Graham and then Mr. Downey.
Thank you. Thank you. We've been wrestling with this issue, as you know, for a number of years, and Mr. Zimmerman and I have pressed early on for a greater utilization of the free ride system, and we're both very anxious to know just how productive that has been. But the central issue that concerns me, and I know this is not an easy issue to deal with, is we need metro access for those who need metro access. But the question in our mind is, to what extent is metro access being used by people who don't need it? Now, I think it's intuitive to believe, as I do, that you wouldn't expose yourself to the delays of a metro access vehicle pickup and everything else unless you had to. But the reports that I'm getting on occasion, not repeatedly, is that a lot of people still prefer that, even though they could get on a bus, even though they could go to the subway, assuming elevator and escalator accessibility. And so, you know, I guess my first question is, in terms of the eligibility, how many people in a recent full fiscal year have been examined in terms of eligibility? And what have been the results of that examination?
I don't have those numbers with me today, although obviously I could get them very quickly.
I'm puzzled why you wouldn't have that number here today, because you've got so many other numbers with you, you know, and it would seem to me to be such a basic question, which is how many, can you get the number before this matter is concluded? Can we call for it?
Mr. Graham, perhaps I can respond to you briefly. The Transit Accessibility Center, which opened only in July of last year, is the first effort that this authority has had to actually change the assessment process. Prior to this, all eligibility assessments were outsourced to various locales around the compact area, and as a result, the results were very inconsistent. By establishing the Transit Accessibility Center and putting in a protocol for assessments, we've just begun this process. There are approximately 200 to 300 assessments performed every week.
Here at this authority?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
That's correct. We need to do more.
Yeah, I appreciate the detail you're giving me, but I'm just seeking a simple set of numbers. And you should be able to provide the numbers for the previous system, however inconsistent or whatever they might be. You ought to have numbers to tell us how many assessments were conducted and what the results of the assessment were. Don't you have those numbers, don't you?
We can get them for you, yes.
Okay. Because I'd like to know, and I ask this question without knowing the answer, because I just would like to know just what is happening in terms of the yes or no proposition that you're confronted by. The other question I have relates to the free ride program itself. On page 12 of your presentation, you talk in terms of deferred cost.
Mr. Graham, I know you want to go to 12, but can we have the presentation? She's not. She's still on.
Well, but everybody else was asking detailed questions, so
I just listened
to Mr. Benjamin ask detailed questions. I thought it was a detailed question time.
Okay. No, we're not through the presentation, and I think the information, if we can follow it with a question, I can understand the interruption there. That's the only question I was doing, so that we could get the next question. Mr. Downey is waiting. I want to see if it's relevant.
I'll wait.
Okay. All right. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. The next slide, slide 9, is to do with regional travel training as well as Metro's free ride program. I would like to respond in part to Mr. Graham's statement to do with customers selecting Metro Access over fixed route, even if they may have the ability to use fixed route. And I'd like to say this, and I say this partially as an individual with a disability and somebody who came from an advocacy background, there are, just as with people without disabilities, within the world of people with disabilities, there are many different people with many different upbringings, with many different abilities, and many different confidence and comfort levels. And one of the goals of this regional travel training program, as well as Metro's pre-existing and continuing to exist travel training program, is to work with people who may not have the comfort and confidence and knowledge of our fixed route system to better prepare them for utilizing it. It doesn't mean they don't have the ability to use it, but it really, so many factors go into whether somebody may be more comfortable jumping on the bus versus waiting for a ride at their home. And I think we see that in the population of people without disabilities as well. There are people who you know in your neighborhoods who are never going to get on a bus. And then there are many, many people who love and frequently use public transportation. And that does exist within the world of people with disabilities. And although paratransit is public transportation, it is a very different model, and it is a model with which some people are more comfortable. The regional travel training program commenced just this month, and it is supplementing Metro's existing program, and it's going to provide a lot of transit options and increase independence for people who are interested in learning more about using fixed route transportation. And it is a proactive measure to offset demand by reducing customers' paratransit dependence. And it's going to be establishing a lot of best practices through a strong evaluation component to feed people into the program, but also to see the success of it and how many of these people thrive on using fixed route public transportation after being trained.
And below you reference the total free ride program. Mm-hmm. And this is, are these those, the users registered, because with the free ride, PCAs or companions are included.
That is correct, but this would be customers.
Yes.
I wanted to check my heading, yes.
Yes, okay.
Yes, this is based on the customers.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Mr. Graham.
Let me ask the question that I was about to ask before. How do you define deferred cost?
These are, every one of these trips, because by definition, these people are fully eligible for paratransit service, yet many have self-selected to use fixed route. By definition, every one of these trips could have potentially been a paratransit trip. Therefore, we refer to it as a deferred cost because it doesn't necessarily reflect a direct deduction from a budgetary line item, but it does show you the potential of what could have been added to the expense line of the paratransit service had these people elected to use paratransit. The track number for this year is, right now this is through January. Our current numbers indicate that if the ridership trend continues the way it is, we will have approximately 549,000 customers or customer trips on the fixed route this year, which would equate at the current cost of a paratransit trip to a deferral of $20,871,000. It's significant because prior to the promotion of the free ride program, these numbers weren't, the ridership wasn't anywhere near that. People were electing paratransit.
But the definition of deferred costs includes a very important, well, it includes two important assumptions. My math would indicate that you're valuing it at $38 per trip.
That's correct.
Is that correct?
That's correct.
But there's an assumption here that these people would have used Metro Access.
Some still do.
Have used Metro Access or would have used Metro Access. So we don't know the universe, correct me if I'm wrong, of the people who have never used Metro Access but have received the free ride and are using that.
That is correct, sir. Because we currently do not have conditional eligibility in place, they're either fully eligible or not. Therefore, if they have the Metro Access card and they have been assessed as being ADA eligible, then their choice is 100%.
That's the question. Right. The question is how many people who we have now given a free ride to have previously used Metro Access? And the more difficult to answer is the question how many of those who have now gotten a free ride car would have used Metro Access? Because I assume there's a universe of people who have never used Metro Access, who, whatever their eligibility, and have used the subway who now have a free car.
We have no way of tracking the individuals who are using fixed route instead of Metro Access. They show their ID, but their ID is not scanned or recorded, so we can't match that person and that ID number with their Metro Access record. It truly is impossible in the way that we implemented the free ride program.
Just following up on that, I understand how you're arriving at this cost avoidance, but that, in my mind, is based on the premise that you have universal eligibility. I would argue these particular trips under a conditional eligibility regime would not be eligible trips.
Would not be eligible for paratransit.
For paratransit. Yes. I mean, by the fact that they are able to use the bus or the rail system, they in fact have defined those as trips that would not be eligible under a conditional eligibility regime.
And for the reason is that we don't know how many of these people that are currently taking advantage of the free ride program are using fixed route for only those portions of the trip, their trips that they can. Some may actually be using both. As Selen pointed out, there's no way under the current system to quantify that.
Mr. Zimmerman, you had a question.
You know, I think I now have two. If I follow up on Mr. Downey's, can I understand both his question and the answer? Does it mean that when Mr. Downey says that they would not be eligible trips under conditional eligibility, is he saying essentially that if you had assessed the eligibility of a user on this conditional eligibility standard, they wouldn't be able to use Metro Access?
The trips that they took on fixed route transportation would not have been eligible as paratransit trips because their conditional eligibility status would have made those trip by trip ineligible for
so they wouldn't have been able to get Metro Access anyway.
For those trips.
Although, since we've never done that in the past, looking backward, those are things for which we paid costs. So in that sense, they've deferred costs under the regime we have always followed.
Correct. Yes.
But not necessarily under the standard that ADA requires.
Yes. The other thing to note is that conditional eligibility in a magical world where technology does everything you want, and you also know everywhere your customers are going, could be truly trip by trip. But in reality, with implementation, and these are some of the details we're working through, chances are Metro is a long way from being able to identify on a literally trip by trip basis which trips you are and are not eligible for. Instead, there might be an examination of the trips that you take regularly, your daily commute, whether you live or work near accessible fixed route, et cetera, to define areas where you would or would not be able to use fixed route.
I'm sure that's going to be useful, but I think to answer the question that Mr. Graham was asking, to which I'd like to return, I don't think you need that. Okay. I think what Mr. Graham is interested in is knowing by instituting the free ride option how much, how many Metro Access trips and the associated cost were in fact deferred, not the notion of some potential outer bound, which is what you've given us here, but how much were likely deferred because X number of trips, some proportion of them, would really have been on Metro Access otherwise. And I don't think you need to know all the level of detail to estimate that. What you need is some estimate of the number of, I mean, there's a couple of ways to approach this. One is how many of the people of this, 500,000 or whatever it is that you expect to be using the free ride program were otherwise using Metro Access? How many of those trips were Metro Access trips? And it ought to be possible to get an aggregate estimate of that based on past experience, including before there was a, you know, from before and after. Because, I mean, we're not talking about something with great accuracy or individual. It's easier to predict something over a large basis when you don't know the specific. It's easier to get a number when you have something to aggregate across. Well, you have lots of data here. And we ought to be able to get a rough estimate, which is all we really need to know here. We're not actually interested in the individuals who are taking them. You might for other reasons care about that. Mm-hmm. But for the purpose of the broad budgetary consideration that Mr. Graham was pursuing, and in fact was pursuing this when he introduced the policy in the first place, all we need to know is roughly, is it a quarter of these, a half of them, three quarters? Some order of magnitude would give us a really good sense of what the impact this is on the budget. The overall size suggests it could be substantial, even if it's a small number. But we really would like to know, is it 10%, 50%, 80%? And I think you ought to be able to provide some estimate of that without knowing all the really specific information.
Under the current system, Mr. Zimmerman, truly there's no way to quantify it other than to give a best guess in the areas of those percentages, because by definition, every one of those deferred trips that you see up there would have been conditionally eligible. Under what conditions and circumstances, there's no way to know without identifying individual customers, because eligibility, and especially conditional eligibility, is literally on a case by case.
I do not understand this. Perhaps we don't employ anyone who understands basic statistical technique. I mean, the crudest way to do it would be a simple survey, which, given that this has been in place for several years now, I'm amazed no one has done. But you know, a simple anonymous survey over a small sample would give you some way to extrapolate. But I would imagine that simply looking at before and after data would be highly suggestive. One year, this program didn't exist. A certain number of people took Metro Access trips. The next year, it did exist. You could make a few assumptions about the growth rate from, you know, year minus one to, you know, year zero, and come up with an estimate that says, you know, some proportion of these clearly must have been taking the regular system who hadn't before or wouldn't otherwise. You know, again, it doesn't have to even be all that precise to get an order of magnitude that would give you within hundreds of thousands and certainly within $1 million a pretty good guess of the impact this program had. This just isn't that hard. I think a graduate student in any one of the fine universities around here could probably do this in a term paper.
Mr. Zimmerman, I think your question goes to, I think, a difficulty that we're dealing with in terms of having watched the who obtained the free ride. The question is, do we have enough data to reflect how many people were actually the same users using the Metro Access or qualified to use the Metro Access and then being able to take the free ride? Now, we could use growth and assume growth, but I don't know if that is the – I think without – something like the conditional eligibility or something else, every question asked about the numbers is a projection that is not based upon any fixed data. Well, that's the question.
It's not based on individual data, but for this purpose, we don't care about individual data. Well, all we need is an aggregate number that is, you know, to some order of magnitude accurate. And you know, that's a fairly basic statistical problem. It wouldn't solve every issue, but it would answer the question Mr. Graham's been trying to get an answer to for the last several years, which, frankly, we should all want to know.
Well, Mr. Graham, I'm going to move on to this one because I think it is a valid concern in terms of us putting magnitude of the impact on the budget. But I think where we are now is to see how do we move people as well as track them. That is, how do we qualify the conditions under which one should be moving, and then quantify the data, the difference of the Metro Access costs to that. And I know what you want to see. I don't think we have heard we have that available to us. And we can ask staff to make projections and see how that can be shared with you. But from this conversation that we're having, I don't think at least staff sees it has the data that you're asking
and
for.
Obviously, based on your questions today, we will take another look at all of the data that we have and see what projections we can find. I know that this is a question we've been trying to answer, but I will definitely take this feedback.
We have a couple of more slides here, that I'd like for you to go to through, because I think there's some other questions, and where do we want to go with the information that we received today?
Okay. I believe we're on to slide 10 now, which are policy options for board consideration. This slide just outlines the four items that the board put on the public hearing docket: the alignment of Metro Access service area within the 3/4 mile, an alternative to that being a charging premium fares or increasing the premium fares for service outside of the 3/4 mile. The revenue potential for option two comes nowhere near the savings and operational efficiency of operating within the 3/4 mile corridor, but that is an alternate option. The third one is aligning the Metro Access fare structure to the maximum allowable under the ADA, which would be twice the equivalent fixed route fare. And then the fourth is restricting the use of the free ride program to those individuals who are certified as conditionally eligible once we move to that process. The next slide covers some additional recommendations, or some recommendations, the first of which is to adopt the proposed policy changes mentioned in the previous slide, to increase resources for the eligibility function by $500,000 annually, and to continue the capital funding for the paratransit fleet. The FTA minimum replacement life is 4 years for the types of vehicles we run, or 100,000 miles, and our current fleet is 519 vehicles, averaging 2.6 years, and we're at about 150,000 miles. And 255 vehicles, or 43% of the fleet, is currently at or beyond 4 years, and is averaging 223,000 miles. So we cannot support the vehicle replacement costs with our operating budget. Sorry, go ahead.
Mr. Benjamin has a question here.
Yes.
Yeah.
Just the second bullet there. You want to increase resources for eligibility by 500,000. Is that above the proposed budget, or is that within the proposed 2011 budget?
This would be above the proposed budget.
And given the fact that we're already very, very, very short on funds, that would mean that we would have to cut service or raise fares for somebody if we were going to do that. Is that right? Or is there a sufficient return on this investment that, in fact, we would save money?
There will be. We've asked, actually, or I have requested that the return on investment analysis be provided. They're working on that now. To the extent that the return can be done in the same fiscal year, FY11, I think that would be a consideration for the board in the budget.
Well, in fact, if that were the case, you could just do it and you wouldn't need the board to say anything.
Okay. Are you completed with that one?
Yes.
Okay. All right. And then the last slide.
The last one is to focus on shared regional resources, because clearly we do have a growing demand for specialized transportation services. And that's the full spectrum between ADA paratransit being one of the more limited, and then some of the more non-emergency medical transportation being more specialized. Jurisdictions focusing on the infrastructure, focusing on accessible pathways so that customers can reach the accessible fixed route transportation that we have, and proactively addressing the load shifting issues through local funding for specialized transportation.
Okay, thank you. And what I think we should do, I think there are some other questions here. And what we're trying to do is gather this information in terms of developing budget policy changes, if there should be. And I think one of the questions, some of the questions regarding the data will be critical when we come back for approving our budget and developing the budget, because I think, for example, on the conditional eligibility piece, I think that has really been a piece that maybe should very easily give us some information as well as some cost savings. But when you talk about that conditional eligibility, you talk about the cost or the intensity of resources that that it requires for that. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And so I think really to come back to the board to share what those resources are needed and why is going to be a critical part in answering some questions, at least I would want to hear. Mr. Linton, and then I don't know if there are other questions.
Thank you. One question I had, and I'm sorry I missed the presentation, but it's one that I tend to have. Have we tracked and have we had good results in making sure that we can get Medicaid and other type of funding to support specialized transportation? And do we feel comfortable both in our audit suggesting that we're getting the maximum amount of those dollars and we've got away with both ourselves and the jurisdictions to make sure that we're following the customer with the funds that are available from other sources?
If I understand your question properly, and please correct me if I do not, we do not take Medicaid money. We do not perform Medicaid trips. And one of the important reasons for not doing that is that those are all based on trip purpose, which we do not track and would be a very different process we would have to go through to do that. So we have not been absorbing any of that funding. I'm not sure if I understand entirely, though.
Well, Mr. Linton.
So in some of the service shifting that has occurred, we have not gotten any service shifting that...
Right. We get the customers. We don't get the money. And we would have to change the way in which we provide service to accept money such as that, and it would stray further from the ADA definition of paratransit.
But we do get the customers.
Yeah. Customers apply for our service if they're not able to get the service from Medicaid or another provider. Go ahead.
Mr. Lee.
And when we get the customers, the trips that we perform would be the trips that they would have gotten through the Medicaid services, correct?
Some of them would be, and some of them might be for other purposes, but yes.
So we have no way of being able to identify and isolate those trips and have a system in place where we could tap those resources?
We cannot request information on trip purpose, and it would stray very far outside of what we provide as public transportation versus specialized transportation.
I understand that, but I think that is one of the problems within the system. And as we're looking to resources, and as we're looking to the jurisdictions, we're looking to the Congress, we're looking to others, and there's been a recognized challenge in the industry of how do you bridge that gap. And as we look to others to help us dig our way out of this, you know, there may be some need to maybe make this region become a pilot and tap those resources, because if the federal government has some responsibilities here, if everyone has kind of moved away from paratransit as something that they're responsible for funding, and if there's some other resources that we can tap, it may mean changing service. It may look at new ways of getting information, but I don't think we should just kind of blow it off as something that we can't do.
Mr. Linton, perhaps I can supplement just briefly, I agree with you, but I do not believe that it's been, quote, blown off either. There has been research performed, and we actually have Mr. Kent, our Assistant General Manager, actually participated in a briefing with the Senate Banking Committee last year regarding this very issue. Mr. Cato was there as well, and there have been discussions with the FTA as well. The issue, as you've so well defined it, is quite real. It's not only regional, but it is national. And the notion of being able to commingle and combine the services, as Celine pointed out, is not only a difficult function, but in some cases contrary to the regulations that are currently in place. And that's one of the reasons that we're presenting this information in the manner in which we are, is to really heighten the understanding that this will require regional and in some cases national resources to address this issue. There have been some small systems across the country who have tried to do this, to do a cooperative specialized transportation. In a very small setting, rural, suburban with low ridership, it has had mixed results. In large urban settings, it has not worked at all because the mechanisms that are currently in place, regulatory and otherwise, actually work against themselves.
Let me say, this has been an issue that even when I was at FTA, we had coordinating councils. There had been pilots. So I'm not speaking from this from the perspective of saying it's easy, okay? And I'm not suggesting that there aren't regulatory barriers. But I also will suggest that regulations can be changed. Statutes can be changed. And, you know, the question is, does our situation in this region rise to the level where we can get an audience to say, let's reassess this. Let's see if we can move some of the mountains that have not been moved before to examine how we can track the funds to go with the customer so that we can reach beyond where we are.
Mr. Linden, I really think that is a major point, and I think it would be interesting if we would check with our jurisdictions and ask how are they delivering services and what are their funding streams, because I think until we have a broader discussion that this is not just a metro issue, it is a regional issue, and if we're not at least the conversation so that we can determine what could be made available to us. I know in some places we are trying to, well, I won't say I know, but knowing customers that are served by some of the systems, the question needs to be answered. Are they receiving those resources other than just what we are familiar with?
We could bring the regions together, but mm-hmm. even when we bring the regions together, ultimately it's going to require us to go to the Hill.
Right.
So the foundation of the region would be very helpful, mm-hmm. But ultimately the relief you're going to need is going beyond the region. So as long as we understand that, then we're fine.
Yes, Mr. Downey and Mr. Grant.
Yeah, I just want to follow up on Mr. Linden's comment. This is, without question, a national issue. I talk to people all around the country. They are all in the same financial and operational bind, and it may well be the opportunity to have that conversation. It has gone on for a long time. I remember when I worked on the Hill commissioning a GAO study to look at this issue in 1975, when it was small, would be good. But it is now becoming national. Let me just show you the front page of the New York Post from this morning. My former colleagues up there had their board meeting and had to cut $93 million of service out of their budget, which is about one-eighth of their problem. But they have moved in exactly the direction that's being proposed here with respect to paratransit, having discovered that their paratransit subsidy was larger than their subsidy for one of the commuter railroads, as we just cannot afford this. I think the critical mass will develop for debate over this, and the debate could go either way. So I think we do need to be prepared with ideas and with facts to hopefully get additional assistance, but certainly not get additional mandates. So I think we need to be working on that.
That's a key point. Mr. Grant.
On Mr. Lincoln's point, I'd like to see, maybe everybody doesn't need this, but I'd like to see the legal analysis of these hurdles and burdens. Because very often I inquire about things like this, and they don't look the same way once I really examine them. And so can we have, Madam Chair, can you get us a brief legal analysis of what the burdens are in terms of the legal hurdles in terms of obtaining this type of Medicaid subsidy? Is somebody going to say something? Or?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, good. Let me
request for information that you can provide.
Yeah, I just find very often when you really examine this, it's not quite what people say it is, but that may not be the case here. In terms of the policy options for board consideration, I'm very interested in the issue in how all this impacts demand, because you know the increases, for example, premium for service provided. may produce a minimal revenue, may produce minimal revenue, but it may have an impact on how many people are actually using it. And I think that we need to consider that. I know that can be very harsh in some ways, but I think it's a reality of what we're looking at. And we've also been given no numbers in terms of the last two policy options on page 13, aligning the Metro Access fare structure to the maximum allowed and restricting the use of the free ride program only to those certified with conditional eligibility. What would be the 2011 savings for these?
Aligning the fare to the fixed route comparable could save up to anywhere between 2.4 and 4.6 million, and then the next one is the restructuring of the free ride program to conditional eligibility only customers. When combined with streamlining eligibility, the eligibility process, it can save between 3 and 5 million. But truly, these are things that it is very difficult to project at this point, not having put the eligibility process into place and, as observed, not having some of the specific numbers to do with how people are and are not self-selecting from paratransit to fixed route for the free ride program.
And the impact on demand issue, what do you have to say about that?
I would say that the vast majority, about close to 93%, of the trips that are taken in the premium fare zones are taken in zone one, which is the least expensive of the zones. So that is why, one, your potential for savings is as low as it is, even though the fares proposed go up quite high. And additionally, since that is in fact the lowest fare, though there may be some people who choose not to travel out there, it is the most manageable among them. But while we leave the service area as broad as it is, covering an additional 580 square miles, we are in fact leaving ourselves open for more people to move into the region and move further out in the region and still be eligible for paratransit in areas where we currently do not have a great deal of traffic, but may in the future, particularly as people with economic issues themselves move out of perhaps, you know, the downtown area and the denser suburbs and further out towards the edges of the county.
And finally, how many individuals are participating in this program today?
In Metro Access, we are at approximately 28,000 now.
28,000.
Customers who are registered.
And how many are in the free ride program?
Anybody who is registered for Metro Access.
Because we've sent the free ride cards to everyone.
They utilize their Metro Access ID card.
They utilize, but they're able to use it. Yeah. So there's 28,000 people. Don't you believe that at some point we're going to see if the free ride program ought to be having an impact on the increases in terms of budget and ridership with Metro Access? At some point, ought there not to be a decline in that as a result of effective use of free rides, not simply being able to say that it would be so much greater but for free ride, that in fact that we would begin to, these numbers would begin to fall? Is that realistic or unrealistic?
It's quite realistic, and you have centered in on the very essence of conditional eligibility. Basically, all of this is the outcome and benefit of conditional eligibility, as is the three-quarter mile corridor. As Solan was responding to you earlier about possible trip-by-trip eligibility, we do have technology that can do this, but it maps around the fixed routes, and that's how the ADA intended it. If we are to be able to accomplish all of the things that I believe we all wish to do in this room, The keys to this will be being able to operate within the corridor and establishing a very robust conditional eligibility process, which is already in way. Once we implement it, I believe we will be able to start showing significant results.
But you just prompt one more question, and I know we've got to move on. But in terms of the conditional eligibility review, you don't need to call in all 28,000 people, do you? I mean, isn't there a way in which we can identify those people who are most likely to be amenable or appropriate for conditional eligibility?
We definitely cannot target people. So anything that would speed up a recertification process would have to be a customer volunteering. Metro could not in any way, based on any analysis that we may have done or could do in the future, say, you know, you live close to fixed route, and therefore we're going to bring you in for certification sooner, because that would be targeting.
So the conditional eligibility review necessarily has to involve all 28,000?
Well, all of our customers get recertified, so we would stick to the schedule that we committed to when we certified them initially, and we would go through that process. Now, one of the things that I believe, I'm sure that the Accessibility Advisory Committee would probably encourage, so I suspect that this will be part of conditional eligibility when it is implemented, is that once everybody has gone through a full assessment, there will be varying degrees of future recertification. So it's not like we would necessarily have to do the entire assessment for everybody every time recertification came due. But since this is a very new process, it is important that it be applied equally and evenly to all of our customers. But, you know, there are also many things that the jurisdictions can do, including working on accessible bus stops and paths of travel that will encourage some of our customers to say, for instance, if the free ride program is aligned with conditional eligibility, you know what? I want to self-select. I want to come to you and say, yes, I can use fixed route some of the time. Give me that option of riding bus and rail for free, and I'm going to make these decisions and transport myself as independently as possible as much of the time as I can.
Mr. McKay.
Thank you. In the appendix, there's a sheet that mentions that if we were to self-insure our Metro Access fleet, we could save possibly up to $2 million. And I guess my question is, one, when is the assessment from Office of Risk Management due? When did we figure out that this was a possibility? And could you elaborate on how you decided or how you arrived at the conclusion that there could be a possible savings there?
Actually, in our review that we are doing currently on Metro Access in preparation for the budget, we had come to understand that the insurance is responsibility is taken over by the contractor that provides the service. And as we were looking at that, we actually requested actuarial information to try to understand the claim activity over the last few years. Once we got that information, we realized that there could be a possibility to take on that insurance program in-house, as we do for our other modes, for rail and for bus. We're self-insured, as you know. Mm-hmm. So I know there's some discussions that are happening now because we have some legal discussions. There's a risk assessment that's continuing on, and then we're trying to understand the impact of that program. But the estimate that you see here is the analysis to date where we are. We intend to bring that final to the board, actually, I believe on April 8th, when we come back at the next FA committee meeting, we will be bringing this to the board as part of some other mitigating costs that we will try to incorporate into the budget discussions.
Okay, good. I'm glad to hear that date, because obviously that could be a potential significant amount of money that has no impact on the experience of the riders. So I'm curious to see more information on that and glad to hear it's coming back soon.
Yeah, and obviously there's risk associated with that, but, you know, it's we'll be able to present that fully on the 8th.
Mr. Zimmerman, I know you had several questions, and I'd like to ask if you would like them in writing, if that's possible.
Actually, I'm going to do that. I have a
question. Okay. Because I think it would be all helpful in terms of circulating to.
But I did see one here that I didn't know. Perhaps someone has already asked about this. Has there been any any discussion of the table in the appendix on page 17?
Yes, we reference the discussion in terms of looking at the larger map and how that should, that table.
Maybe it's a simple question. This must be a typo, I assume, in the table. Yeah, so that was discussed. And it is really the case that the number for Prince George's is more than four times that of the next jurisdiction, five times that of the largest jurisdiction in the region? Two-thirds of the total number?
Yes, for trips.
I know, but of that class of trips, it's just it's such an outlier, so beyond. Two-thirds of all of those in the region?
The 700 customers, yeah.
Or Mr. Jackson.
Yeah, it's approximately 700 customers.
Mr. Zimmerman, that chart really speaks to the larger debate here, because I think when you look at those, well, not when you look at how the distributions of the trips occur around the region, it's really important in terms of how we talk about restructuring the system.
This says that 3.4% of total trips, this class of trips. What percentage of costs are those trips?
The numbers that we've provided to do with potential savings have been based solely on the cost per passenger trip. Clearly, having the considering that we're traveling much further outside of our core service area for just 3.4% of the trips, our deadhead, our early pullouts, our late pull-ins, our extra shifts necessary to cover those hours for longer lengths of trips are all in play, but that has not been factored in as potential savings quoted. So the savings could be greater than provided.
I'm not sure I understood, but my question is just if the 61,268 trips referred to on this table constitute 3.4% of total trips, what percentage of cost do those 61,268 trips constitute?
Right. Well, it's 2.4 million, and I don't have the...
Without doing the math, it's fairly close at 2.4 million on approximately an $85 to $90 million budget. So it's about 2.5 to 3%. And
2.4 million dollars.
If it were a $100 million budget, it'd be 2.4%. We're going to end up at about 90 million this year.
Okay. So are you saying these trips cost about the same as any other trip? They're not on average more expensive trips.
If you factor in fuel, pull in, pull out, overtime, that sort of thing, they're going to be more expensive, significantly.
Then they would have to be more than 3.4% of the cost.
Yeah. Only 3.4% of the cost per passenger. That's the only factor that's being quoted.
And ask cost per passenger. I ask cost in the budget as a whole. I think it's clear that you don't have the answer to this question.
Yeah,
I just asked that somebody look into this.
Why don't
give
we
us an
simply ask
what percentage of cost
the answer.
These trips, which presumably are higher cost trips, constitute out of the entire budget?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. This item has come to us as a part of our budget structure, and I would hope that if there are any other questions we have, that we submit them so that staff can provide some answers for us, because I think it'll be critical. And I think one piece that we have to also think about when we talk about the conditional eligibility and moving people to the fixed rail and bus system is that there's a lot more work that's going to be done, not only in the transport aspect, but the capability of getting people there. And I think the two pieces in the appendix talks about truly access to fixed rail. The good news about that is when we improve access to fixed rail and bus, we improve it for everybody. And it also improves the larger ridership of our system to everybody. So I think that makes that a very important piece. The next item on the agenda is the approval for the award of the Dulles 7000 series rail cars. And this is a procurement item that starts us in the process of a whole new series of rail cars and the future of not only the extension, but I think of the Metro Rail system rail cars. And it's a transition that is much different than what we have today. Mr. Kubit.
Good morning, Madam Chair. At this point in time, what I'd like to do is introduce some of the project team that's associated with this. As y'all know, we've been discussing this with y'all for the past couple of years. So in the interest of time, I'll be really quick and just have the individual stand up. Kevin Green with our contract side. We've got Mike Hiller, our chief engineer. We've got Kunj Bahari, who's also in our contract team. We've got Badibo Ogurindi. We can call him Debo. We really appreciate that. He's a very patient man. We've got Damon Cannon from our engineering side as well. Barry McGuire, also from engineering. We've got Douglas Miller from our rail car maintenance. And to my left of me, direct left, is Mr. Randy Posey, who works with me on our capital side. And Raj Sharif, on the finance side.
Raj is our treasurer of the authority.
Okay, if we could, the first is basically to inform the committee on the results of the 7,000 series rail car procurement. To award the 64 rail cars, as well as award option 4 for the 300 rail cars to replace the 1,000 series, and also to approve the financing plan. Next slide. Basically, what we're looking at is a long-term approach for the agency. Typically, we've always bought in certain segmented procurements, which has increased our expenses, basically in overhead parts, not knowing what level of technology that we're going to be getting for the future, and it's just created a lot of complications. So what we're looking here is over the next 10 years of what this agency is going to be facing. So what we have here is, again, on the top is top two is the base is the 64 and the options are 300. The other ones that are, you know, unfunded, but they're identified in this overall project looking forward and what this agency is going to be facing is going to be the midlife overhaul of the 4,000 series, Dulles Phase 2, whenever we get awarded for that, and then also our future growth cars that are going to be needed to get it to 100% 8-car trains. So that was the philosophical approach to, we know it's coming, so let's go ahead and capitalize on it right now. Next slide, please. Okay, selection process. This was a best value procurement. It was a firm fixed price with economic adjustments for options. Award is to be made to responsible offer whose proposal is provides the best overall value to the authority. We also evaluated this as not only was just low bid, but it was also about the life cycle costing of this rolling stock, because we're going to have assets here. They're going to be here for 40 years. So we need to make sure that we can not only maintain them and have the right technology at this time frame, but also push the envelope in our day-to-day maintenance activities, establish these rail cars towards whenever we go into a midlife overhaul program 16 or 20 years from now, that they are structurally and physically designed to really be retrofitted in a very aggressive manner with nominal expense to the agency at that time of that investment. And, you know, the best value award ensures that the authority attains, you know, the highest level of technical and the most reliable piece of equipment at a reasonable price. Okay. Selection process, again, on the price and technical factors were evaluated and ranked. Price is for the total bid price, including options. So, again, we're talking about 748. Technical factors, again, of the firms we evaluated was their adequacy, the availability, schedule, managerial approach, and history and past performance of all of the firms that we worked with. We were very, very fortunate with this approach that we got a tremendous turnout from the industry as a whole. We had 7 car builders that actually submitted. After the initial evaluation, 4 car builders were not in the competitive range and were eliminated. And the 3 prime car builders that we focused and worked with throughout this process were Alstom Transportation, Bombardier Transportation, and Kawasaki. Okay. On the final proposal evaluation, Kawasaki Railcar achieved the highest technical ranking, strongest technical approach and some strengths, you know, their system safety of the way that they put the cars and work together, their quality assurance, One of the things that we'd also like to note is that the U.S. built stainless steel car construction, with the exception of the first four pilot cars, the remainder of these rail cars will be built here in the United States. That has not happened here at this agency until the, I believe, the Roars were built here in the United States. But everything else has been, for example, from a car body stand frame, was built out of the country and then was shipped in. These will be built here in the United States. And I think that lines up very nicely with the job creation bill and everything else. And for us also, it's nice to have that technology and that support. That way we can really help monitor the, you know, the overall project and program. But that was very important for us. We're talking about a totally new crash energy management car design with this platform. You know, we've made some other structural changes with this rail car, moving doorways and everything else that are around. So this is a different modeling altogether, very cutting edge. Open architecture for a train network. Basically, this thing is a rolling computer that communicates, everything talks to each other. We are really trying to establish an environment towards our operators have the necessary information real time at their fingertips to make decisions on the fly. As well as when our maintenance staff are working on this thing, everything is networked, and it reduces the redundancy of troubleshooting. Other items, passively cooled propulsion. This is also very important. We have a lot of propulsion faults here. This rail car will have a system that requires no assisted cooling or anything else. It is a very, very robust design and platform. Overhead utilization of environmental systems. We're going to get away from the air conditioning systems that we have, where we have part of the air conditioning underneath the car and part of it up in the cab area. It's going to help eliminate a lot of leaks that we have on customers. It's also going to make it more robust, and it'll be a hermetically sealed, self-contained unit. It's close to a, I guess you could say, a refrigerator or a large reefer unit. Everything is going to be self-contained. We're also, as y'all know, we've also been testing LED lighting. You know, on one of our, couple of our rail cars right now, this series of fleet will have LED lighting on it from day one. And the other thing is that the Kawasaki at their plant in Nebraska, they have a very extensive test track as well, which is also going to be very critical. We still need our test track to actually commission it and work it here, but their facilities were also very impressive by the staff. Final proposal on the valuation, getting into cost. Basically, we're looking at a total price of 748 rail cars, approximately about $1.48 billion. It was about $120 million next to the lowest bid. And total base price was about $765 million for 364 cars. Next slide.
And Mr. Kubitschek, the, yes, the 364 breakdown is the 64 plus
the 300. Yes. It's the 64 is Dulles Phase 1, and the 300 is the Aurora fleet.
Right.
Okay. This.
Yes, Mr. Green.
Clarification. Insofar as the 64 cars relating to the Dulles extension, the cost of those cars is being borne by the Metropolitan Washington,
yes,
Airports Authority. So there's no cost to Metro associated with those 64 cars.
That is correct.
That is correct. So the cost that's associated, that Metro has to bear, is for the 1,000 series replacement cars as proposed, which is 300.
Yeah, that the proposal for you, yes, sir.
And so can you just show me in the presentation where the breakdown is on those two cost factors?
If I could have to go to the next slide.
Thank you.
There you go. What we have here is basically Dulles Phase 1. You have the pricing for these rail cars. Basically, the rail car project is overall is 221. That includes all of your spares and everything else. You're looking at a project budget of 264, which incurs everything, consultant services, I mean, everything to get the project, you know, to completion. The Roar replacements, and again, this is where you start seeing the economy of scale coming into place for this overall project. For the agency, we would be looking at the number of 751 $6.9 million. That's fully loaded, fully burdened with everything. And we basically did provide on the next layer down to kind of give like a total magnitude of what we're going to be looking at working with the internally of the agency and with the airport authority is a little over $1 billion. I'd also like to point out at the bottom, because this was also in our previous slides, as y'all are aware, y'all were very patient with us and very diligent as we spent about a year doing various presentations and about talking about economy of scale and looking at a global approach. At the bottom of the slide, whenever we, in our presentations, we had kind of forecasted that, you know, regardless of who bear the expenditures of this, we were looking at about 2.064 billion dollars for this project for 748 rail cars. This is going out over 10 years. Our estimate and what we've negotiated to date and what we're working at with the everything loaded, it came in at 1.978, which is 4.3% under what we forecasted. I would say based on the financial times, because this was released before the economies on a global market crashed, this speaks volumes to the quality of the statement of work, our contract team, having the ability to go out on a large scale. I would also like to point out in this number of this 1.978, whenever we talked about the 4,000 series rail cars, in which we had referenced the rehab, which is option three, this contract for those 100 rail cars will be 100% replaced with a brand new rail car. That is also very, very important to point out to this board. That will be a brand new rail car interjected. We will not be rehabbing an existing fleet, and we will be replacing it. We will have a like fleet. I think that's also very powerful to point out.
Meaning that the shell will not be a shell. It will be a new.
It'll be 100% brand new rail car. Basically, we'll be able to take the 4,000 series fleet, 100 of them, and set them off to the side. We could sell them or do whatever we want to. This contract and this structure, when we come back to a war or to request to exercise this next option, we would replace it with a brand new rail car. And also from a program perspective, you know, we don't have to take rail cars out of service, missing service and everything else. So it's makes it that much more special to me to be able to pull this. And again, I'll keep repeating, the economy of scale is very important for us to do this.
Mr. Benjamin has a question.
And you're saying that the cost to replace them will be less than the cost to rehab them, or be slightly more?
With our proposers that we were looking at, it would have cost more to rehab them versus to replace them.
So it's cheaper to replace them than rehab them. Have we talked to the Federal Transit Administration, because these were bought under one of their grants? Will they allow us to replace rather than rehab, since when we buy one of these things, we say we're going to keep them for their useful life?
I have not spoken with them 100% directly until we get the authority to move forward. My initial discussions and listening with talking with other industry folks is that they have been able to replace, you know, vehicles.
Typically, that's one of those things that's very hard to do. And what concerns me here is you're providing a lot of really good information. It's the first time that I've seen it. It's the first time that other board members have seen it. Parts of this, without a doubt, are things that we want to do and we want to move ahead. Other parts are ones that I'd really like to have some better answers on to make sure that I understand what it is we're doing. That relates particularly to some of the financing options and changes in our capital program. So this is the kind of thing I'd like to get an answer to before we commit to something that may cause us a problem in the future.
Mr. Benjamin, if I could, while we've not had specific discussions on these cars, looking at their policy in regards to replacement of rail cars, it is not specific whether it's 20 years or 30 years. There is a range depending upon, you know, the cost of rehab versus replacing them. I'm very optimistic based upon what Mr. Kugacek said and what I have talked to people about, that we will get a favorable discussion with the FTA, but we've not had it because we don't have the direction to move forward yet.
Mr. Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a quick safety question. Will these cars react any differently in an accident than the old cars?
We will be moving forward with a different energy management. There will be different parameters that these cars will be working under, yes.
And then how about in a collision situation?
Yes, these cars will have different crash-worthy characteristics, or what we call energy management.
Absolutely. Absolutely, meaning what happened in the other crash, the cars will not separate, or do they, what happens in a collision? Will they be different? I'm not an engineer, so I don't know how to put the question properly, but will they respond the same, or will they respond differently?
They will have definitely inherent differences of what we've seen with the 1000 series.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Also, if I could point out on this, Mr. Benjamin, is that, again, today's action is not surrounding the 4000 series and about what we can or cannot do. This is about us being able to exercise these or at least get permission to start negotiating these first two options.
If I may explore that further, one of the things I'd like to understand before we take any action is what are we actually committing ourselves to if the board approves at this point?
Yeah, I think there is some language at the tail end of this presentation that will also make that very clear.
Okay, and I think they're giving us a little bit of flexibility there in terms of time to understand what's all in here and how much we are locked in is going to be very important to us as we make this decision.
If I could just follow up on that. We'd be interested in knowing not only what are we approving, what are we not approving, and what might be our future options. Let's just hypothetically put forward the thought that these cars don't turn out to be as good as we think they are. Do we have the option in the future for the balance of the fleet to re-procure from another manufacturer?
We do. I mean, basically what we're only talking about execution today is the Dulles Phase 1 and the replacement of the Roar, the 300 rail cars. Everything else is an option, and again, it's funded. It was a model that we approached to say, instead of us every two or three years coming back and trying to redevelop a new car and a new program, we strategically said, let's take advantage of what we see is coming towards us.
And that's advantageous both to us and to the manufacturer as they do their business plan, but to the extent that the cars beyond 364 are not committed, they're taking some risk on that.
Absolutely, and that puts the pressure on them as well to ensure that they deliver us a quality product for us to sustain our business relationship with them over the course of this program.
Okay. Mr. Linton, yes.
One of the aspects of your process, which I'm very pleased with, is the idea of having the cars assembled and manufactured here in the United States. Because one of my concerns has always been the inspection and the ability to be able to follow the cars through the process prior to delivery so that we can make sure the kind of quality controls that we need is actually in place. So I'm very pleased to hear that part of your process. One other issue, the open architecture. You know, one of the things that we're even more now with rail cars is that it's not just the cars and the motors and the engines, but it's the electronics that both causes us a lot of the efficiencies, but also what causes us a lot of the pain. And in the open architecture and in the electronics and the computer ends of the systems, what are our testing and alarms and alerts? Systems that we have in place, and what's the ability to be able to utilizing other open architecture, which seems to me that you can buy from others to replace when, in fact, you need to do so.
Okay. We do have an extensive, test plan that is established for this. I would say that the selection process, if I could, is that we also really stressed in our statement of work, not only on the car builder, because again, the top three that we have, they're clearly very competent, you know, car builders. They build stuff all over the world. But we also focused on system integration and also our key sub-suppliers for braking, propulsion, air conditioning. And we do have some comments further in the presentation that we were going to talk with a little bit about this. With the way that we're going to be networking these systems, it's about real-time information. It's about us matching systems that work together already, and we're not having to go back and marry technology that is 20 or 30 years old and try to make it work on top of something that is, you know, 4 or 5 years old. So the equipment package on this rail car is all in a very positive and aggressive life cycle of technology that will be supported for a long, long time. The other component is with us having this economy of scale, we'll be able to sustain and also entice other competitors over the years because we have a sizable investment in a set technology platform.
And one final question. I know you have indicated in the document that you selected a manufacturer. I would like to see, and I think the board would like to see, the full range of the team, because that only represents the major car builder. There are probably several other members of the team that is represented here in the actual build out of the system. We would like to see all the team members that are aligned with this manufacturer. That'd be helpful for us.
When you say team, are you talking about sub-suppliers?
The subcontractors, okay. Those who are working on various elements of the production. I'd like to see the full build out of what's represented here.
Okay.
Following up on that, in terms of the subcomponents,
Mr. Downer, Mr. Graham and Ms. Hewlett are waiting, but I'll get to your question.
Am I correct in assuming that we still have flexibility insofar as the interior configuration of these cars? That's my recollection from the last discussion I was a part of, that we would come back to that, and that there's still an ability to impact that issue.
We did submit updated renderings as requested at the board meeting that we had discussions. Also in part of this package, there's also additional renderings of options that we would talk through. So I was definitely planning on talking about the interior layout and renderings if so permitted.
Or if so permitted. Oh, that's right. We haven't finished the presentation. But we're all just so, everybody's very anxious to comment here. What do we do, Madam Chair?
I think we should go to Ms. Hewlett.
So we're now on just factual questions. We're not on speeches. Is that right? Just factual questions.
Okay, Ms. Hewlett.
Yes, thank you. I think there's a lot here that is very, very appealing. As Mr. Linton said, first of all, it's manufactured in the United States, and secondly, the technology that these cars have is very, very impressive and will go will certainly enhance our system tremendously. And I know somebody asked this question already. Oh, the other main thing I like is the 4.3% savings that you all have under what you had forecasted, so that's tremendous as well. But somebody asked this question, and you didn't really answer it yet. You said we'll get to it at the end in terms of what is it that you're asking us to approve today. And that's what I feel I need a little bit more information. I heard you say something about that you're to proceed with negotiations, but I
think
sneaked
that
back.
Would be the action that will take place here.
If we could, we do have, there is a resolution attached to this. There's another resolution that we're talking about for short-term financing that we'd like to pass out. The primary focus of this effort today is to get concurrence by the boards for us to proceed forward with negotiations for the Dulles Phase 1 of 64 rail cars, as well as the option 4, which is the 300 rail cars, the rural replacement, as well as a financial component of that on how we choose to move forward, and there are options there.
Okay. Ms. Cook.
All right. Because that's, everything sounds really impressive. I just want to get a really good idea of what it is that we're doing and how much we're binding ourselves at this juncture, since we didn't have much of a chance to review these financial aspects before. So that's my concern, and what your real-time constraints are.
Okay.
Mr. Downey.
Yes, question following up on Mr. Linton. In terms of the subsystems, were those specified by Metro, or was it Kawasaki's choices to what to offer?
What we did in our statement of work, we were very aggressive in outlining the level of technology that we were really looking for. You don't want to get yourself into a position where you're generally trying to call out, you know, particular folks. That causes a lot of problems in the public environment, as we all know. So we did look at a technology platform. It was very specific. With that being said, then it was upon the rail car builders to basically go out and solicit that level of technology to meet our expectations.
I mean, understanding that a rail car builder is really only a system integrator.
Yes.
They've got to have some accountability for the choice of the systems if we're going to hold them to performance.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. For example, one of the things that we did different on this project that was written in the statement of work, which has never been done here, is that we had a systems integration test process where we're basically we're taking all the major subcomponents and they'll be assembled without a rail car shell, and they will actually be integrated to ensure that they work on a combined systems integration test. That was something that was heavily discussed during this process, but on my part it's very vital because it pushes the suppliers to prove that they can actually perform before it's even mounted on a rail car. It's nice to tell me
they perform in concert with each other.
There you go. It's nice to tell us that it works someplace else, but we want to see what it does for us.
And it's also my understanding that the Kawasaki body plant is actually in existence now.
That is correct.
It's not a promise to do one. It exists out in Lincoln.
Absolutely.
Ms. Kubitschek, can we keep moving? Can we keep moving?
Absolutely.
Okay,
with that, I'll turn it over to Raj.
Thanks, Dave. Good morning. The top half of the slide summarizes the savings we can achieve by exercising the order for $64 for Dallas and the $300 replacement cost to replace the 1,000 series. The first, I'm sorry, if you can go back to the previous, okay. The first two sub-bullets under the main bullet, that's those are price discounts or reductions the manufacturer will offer if we agree to procure all 300 cars now. The 8.6 is the price reduction, and the other two, 13 and the $2 million, are more in the nature of cost avoidance, if you will, because the vendor is willing to absorb price escalation, which we think will give us a savings of about $13 million, as well as a foreign exchange risk. That would result in a total savings of about $23.6 million now.
So that first 300 is brings us to this financial commitment and the savings that's realized.
That's correct, ma'am. Yeah. Moving on to the second half of the slide, at the bottom of the slide is how by a combination of both short and long-term financing, Metro could exercise the option to procure all 364 cars, but at the same time relieve the jurisdictions of funding for them in the near term. That's going to be accomplished by number one, which is there's only one milestone payment that's required in 2011, sometime in the month of August, in the amount of $65 million. We could make the milestone payment by either our existing lines of credit or from the vendor-provided interim financing, which I'll talk to a little bit later. And also, taking advantage of the current low funding cost, we can issue long-term bonds sometime in the fall of this year for about $100 million for two things. Number one, to make any system safety improvements recommended by NTSB. Number two, to pay down the short-term financing. There is also a program called Build America Bonds, which would sunset by December 31, unless it's extended by Congress, that would further lower our borrowing cost. The next slide talks about the alternate financing if a six-year funding agreement is not completed in time, that would give us the obligating authority to procure all 364 cars. That's done by a combination of the $300 million interim, or what's called a bridge financing, by Sumitomo Mitsui Bank. We have an agreement in concept with Sumitomo on the key terms of the operative documents, subject, of course, to board approval, finalizing the documents. That, in combination with the existing lines of credit of over $250 million, will give us a total authority of $550 million. That would be enough to procure the 300 cars. And lastly, it's the Build America bonds I just talked about. If we issue that sometime in October, November, I think, as I said before, we can pay down the interim financing, which we would take out to pay for the milestone payment in August, as well as make other improvements recommended by NTSB. And the last slide is a recommendation to seek approval from the board to complete the negotiations with Sumitomo Mitsui to execute the term sheet and other necessary operative documents. And some of the key terms of the financing are, it's a commitment of $300 million with an interest cost not to exceed LIBOR plus a margin of 150 basis points. Actually, that's a worst-case scenario, given the current market conditions and where WMATA's ratings is. It's going to be LIBOR plus 120 basis points, which would translate to about 1.5% interest rate in the current market environment. And the second bullet point is, again, seek board approval not to issue but to negotiate long-term bonds to take out the interim financing of $65 million, as well as to make other improvements, which I talked about earlier. And the last one is to seek approval to execute extensions to the existing lines of credit, which will expire on June 30th, for substantially the same terms. Actually, we'll be able to renew them at lower interest rates, given where the market is right now. That in a nutshell, is what we're seeking in terms of financial approvals.
The commitment to move forward under those financial improvements there. Are there any questions regarding that? Mr. Downey?
Yeah, a couple of questions so I understand. The premise of savings on the 300 is as compared to waiting at some future time to exercise.
Waiting for 2 years to exercise the option, that's correct. So,
buying now, good price. But we need to put financing in place. If the cost of that is $750 million, which is what I see, I only see $400 million of financing. What's making up the rest of it?
$750 includes both the 64 Dulles cars, which is funded by Dulles.
Okay.
And the 300, the cost of the 300 is a tad less than $550, about $545 approximately. And the interim financing is a combination of 300 from Sumitomo and the 250 of the existing lines of credit, which would take us to 550.
Okay, so it's all on credit until the six-year plan is put in place. The other question I had, quick arithmetic here tells me that the Dulles cars are about $4 million each, and the replacement cars are about $2.5 million each. How was the cost allocation arrived at, and has the Airports Authority signed off on that?
We had a budget, you know, with them. Mm-hmm. In fact, we have a follow-up meeting with them tomorrow morning. We have not discussed or disclosed any of the numbers at this point in time, but there was a separate budget that we have to meet with them on.
So essentially, we're saying the premise would be they're going to pay what they would have to pay if mm-hmm. they went out and bought only 64 cars, mm-hmm. and the buy-in-bulk savings that we're generating will be used for the Metro cars.
Yeah. Also, an important component of this is that we did put, even though we put in Dulles Phase 2, which is going to basically prohibited us for, or I guess, prevented us from having to go out and buy 64 cars at one time and they bear everything, and then you wait 3 or 4 years and you do another standalone 64 procurement. So that's where this economy of scale will definitely benefit them.
But we haven't priced out their second 64.
It is priced out.
Yes, we received a separate bid for each of the options.
Okay, so we know what that is. We have to decide whether or not to exercise it at a later date.
And again, that's
or
what,
to improve on it.
And so that's again, is very positive because that way we can lock things down in, you know, this time frame versus having to wait several years and you don't have the leverage of the scale.
So just so that is clear, the 64 that Dulles has at a higher cost, if we had simply had nothing else to do for them, that would have been a high cost to them no matter what. And so they really do benefit through this process because in the next procurement for the remaining, they should have the benefits there if they make that choice.
If the Dulles program had gone ahead and purchased these cars independently, they would have paid a higher unit price than they are right now.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes, Mr. Benjamin.
Who's next? I guess my concern again goes back to what is it that we're approving. I first of all want to thank you for a really solid job, carefully done, very well thought through, certainly one of the most attractive bids I've heard described in a very, very long time. So you've done an excellent job. You clearly have spent a lot of time thinking through all the different options and how they could be played out and how they could be financed. And I now have had 15 minutes to look at it and to look at a $1 billion change in our budget. I don't understand from this yet, even though I get the basic outlines of it, what the implications of the various financing options would be, how introducing this into the budget that we have yet to approve, which would change it, how that would change, what it would do in terms of debt payments by the various jurisdictions, and things along that line. So the question I guess I have is, can we have enough time as a board, since you just put this in front of us and we haven't really had a chance to look at it, think about it, talk with the people who've got to come up with the money for all of this to happen eventually, to look at the broader financing issues, and can we go ahead right now with the 64 cars, assuming that that the airport's authority is willing to accept them at a higher price than the others? Can we go ahead and approve that and say 30 days from now come back and discuss the financing and the potential approval for the other cars, which I think are critically important, and we do want to replace as soon as possible, but there are an awful lot of implications, which I certainly in 15 minutes haven't had much time to even think through and know what questions to ask you.
Apologize, I'm just kind of trying to go through that if we potentially, wait, we could be put in a position there, we could lose funding or some of the price reduction options.
If I may add something, definitely that would be a risk we would be taking. Also, the commitment, the extremely low-cost financing commitment from Sumitomo, again, could be, I'm not saying it will go away if we wait for a month, but that could potentially be jeopardized by that.
I find it very, very difficult to vote and carry out my fiduciary responsibility without really understanding what I'm doing. And I suspect the other board members feel somewhat the same. It seems to me that if, in fact, you wanted us to vote today, you had an obligation to give us some of this information early enough for us to actually look at it, think it through, work it through, if necessary, discuss it with the people who actually provide the money before you ask us to vote on it. So if what you're saying is it's an all or none, then I guess I'm on none. If you're saying we could go ahead with the 64 and leave the others for later, that's a different issue. Another side question, just because it's going to matter to lots of people who are looking at this entire deal. Do we know how many jobs are likely to be created by this in the United States and approximately when? Because that's an important part of what we're doing here.
That has definitely been kind of a discussion on our part to basically finalize that number. We do not have that number 100% yet, you know, from them, but absolutely would be, a very good item for us to market this project and program.
Do you have even the vaguest sense, order of magnitude? Are we talking about 10 jobs, 100 jobs, or 1,000 jobs?
The job definitely would be in the hundreds. I mean, yeah, typically when you're looking at a final assembly plant for something on this size, you're easily talking anywhere from 400 to 800 people. So for us to finalize that, you know, we would have to work, you know, with Kawasaki.
And that would occur in Nebraska?
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Kubitschek, will any of those be union jobs?
Pardon?
Are any of them union jobs?
We would have to look to see what the, you know, every state varies on it, whether they're a right-to-work state or unionized. So those are questions that we'd have to vet there.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I just want to check whether some of the broader technical questions, not finance ones, are appropriate now, or if you want to continue with the presentation.
Well, I think we should continue with the presentation.
Okay.
And then and get the answer about the finance as how we can handle that differently if we should do so. I think there are.
I was just wanting to go ahead on things like, are we talking about four-car consists and stuff?
Okay.
That's later?
Yes, that's coming. That's coming right behind the financing. Mr. Graham, did you have a question?
I do. I think I do want to ask just one question about how we settled on Kawasaki, since this is a very, very big deal. I agree with Mr. Benjamin's comments about whether we can act on this today, though. I think it's, you know, everybody's very anxious for us to replace the 1,000 series cars. I know that. But this is a huge decision for this board. And so before even getting to that point, though, I just want to make sure that we have the right pick here. On page, page 20, 31 of your presentation, you list all these technical strengths, which I just must assume there's something to each and every one of those. But on the next page, page 32, you indicate prices of, you know, a very important factor, obviously. But you indicate that the price ranking is based on the total price of 748 cars, which is nearly 400 cars more than what we are contemplating today, even today. And so I'm wondering, what is this? How does this evaluation? What is the evaluation if you base it on 364 cars, which is what the action is that we are contemplating? Does it materially change? Is Kawasaki Railcar Inc. still the number one choice?
When the procurement was initiated and the RFP was put on the street, we delineated what the terms of the evaluation process would be. And we were going to utilize this as the basis for the award. So it's not really possible for us to go back and say that at this point we're going to use something else.
I just got updated by the staff. If we were to do this as standalone 364, they have confirmed that Kawasaki would still provide the better deal.
Well, that's just the exact opposite of what your colleague has just said.
I was speaking about the process. I mean, in this procurement process, we establish at the beginning certain rules, and we tell the vendors what the process is going to be, and we explain what the basis of the award, how the basis of the award is going to be made, so they know how to price. And we told them in the beginning that this was, and through the process, this was a best value procurement, and part of this was going to be based on the total number of cars. They gave us individual pricing on the option, but the award is based on the total number of 748 cars.
Can you explain to me what the final sentence on page 32 means?
total base price plus option for, that's 364 rail cars. That's the 64 cars for Dulles plus the award of 300.
Right. But here we're discussing, this is final proposal evaluation, and this is the price evaluation. So I just, where is the evaluation in this? What does this mean? What do these words mean in terms of being an evaluation?
The evaluation was based on...
See, in the previous sentence, you tell us that the total price of 748 rail cars is $120 million less than the next lowest price. That's clear to me. But then we get to the final sentence, and it just simply says total base price plus option four, 364 cars, $765 million. There's no evaluation element. There's no comparison element in that sentence, if it is a sentence.
This is Mr. Kevin Green, who is our head of our contracts.
One of them. Good morning. Good afternoon. Oh, good morning. My name is Kevin Green, and I was the chief negotiator for this particular engagement. With regard to your question, Mr. Graham, about the evaluated price, on page 32, the last bullet point, the $765 million refers to the 64 base award contract as well as the 300 in the option. The total evaluated price with regard to all other vendors who were in the competitive range was lower and submitted by Kawasaki was lower.
But that doesn't say that.
I understand.
It doesn't say that. If it said that, I wouldn't have asked the question.
Yes,
because then you would have, we had had the insurance. I know it's $765 million because I can turn the page and see that as a total. But just stated the way it's stated, it doesn't tell me anything beyond what is on the next page. And so now you're saying that the total base price plus option four is lower than any of the other bidders. By how much?
Any of the other bidders in the competitive range.
By how much?
I would have to do that math, sir, and I could do that.
Because you tell us that in the prior bullet point in terms of the 748. I'm just wondering if there is a similar number for the 364.
I don't have that. We can provide that number before the end of this presentation, sir.
And just finally, I mean, are you going to provide us either in executive session or in public session the actual breakdown of this evaluation so that we can see? Because at page 31, just going back there momentarily, quite honestly, I mean, perhaps some other members of this board know more, but it doesn't mean anything to me. I assume that LED interior lighting would be found in Alstom. I don't know, maybe not. It's totally ambiguous to me, page 31. Now we have some more clarity in terms of page 32, because this is the heart of the decision, after all. I mean, this is why one company is going to get $600 million and another company isn't. $765 million. And so I think I'm duty bound in terms of my fiduciary responsibility to at least understand why we're picking Kawasaki. I'm not saying we shouldn't pick Kawasaki, but I just want to understand it. What's the answer to my question? Are we going to get a detail?
Yes sir. We will provide you a detailed analysis with respect to the evaluation for price. In addition to that, the difference between the next lowest vendor and Kawasaki was $80 million for 364 cars.
So how many?
80. For 364 cars, $80 million.
Madam Chairman, I actually wanted to pick up right there as it happens. When I first came onto this board, the agency was involved in the procurement for what would be the 5000 series, and that was my first exposure to best value procurement. And as I recall, the board was initially shown the criteria by which the procurement would be performed. There was an outside engineering firm actually developed that. And then when the bidding process was done, the board was presented with what were the final, I think there were four final bidders, and the matrix that showed how they ranked in terms of the different aspects, including price, but the other things as well, and why the recommendation was being made according to that table. That was an interesting one because it wasn't straightforward that one beat out everybody. There were, you know, at least two close where you had to weigh a number of factors. May or may not have made the right choice as things turned out. The evaluation may or may not have been accurate in certain key respects. But the point is the board saw exactly what it was that the staff had evaluated and the basis for their recommendation. Now, much more recently, just this past year, on another transit board in which I serve, another rail service, had a best value procurement this past year. And there were, in the end, a set of bidders. And there again, the board was presented with a table that showed, here's how they ranked. That one was much easier. One completely beat everybody else in every category. But we could see and question on each one, what was the score on this? This was the criteria that you were evaluating on, and we can understand why that was, and we could see this is the score. We were given the actual scores for each thing that those who had done the evaluation had made. So we could understand entirely the reason for the recommendation. So a lot of the kind of questions that people are asking now, the kind of first order questions, we knew because it was already in front of us, and you could go right to the next order of questions. Now, in my experience with procurements like this, and generally with pure procurement in the governments I participate in, they're arm's length. They're meant to be. People like us aren't supposed to be picking who the winners and losers are. On the other hand, we are responsible for the outcome, and this is an extraordinary action in the history of the agency. I mean, you only do it every so many years. It's a lot of money for a long time, and it's really important because there's, you know, not much, you know, that quite ranks with the actual vehicles people ride in on the rail system. And in this case, it's a generational change that is being proposed to us to make. I mean, I think all that makes sense. And I agree with Mr. Benjamin's statement that, you know, this looks like it was done very deliberately. You know, we started discussing this a couple of years ago. We understand the reason. It took a long time to do. We were anticipating it last month it was going to be before us, and at the last minute it got yanked. This month, you know, it was on the schedule. The materials we received before today were all basically old stuff that were good, you know, background reading and refresher. But we didn't actually see anything substantive until this morning when we walked in here. And that's kind of amazing to me. But what's really amazing to me is what we're not seeing in terms of the actual justification for the award, which I have no reason to question. But the board really should know this before it decides to spend $755 million. And the notion that we have to sign today or we're going to lose the deal, which, you know, to me, really strains credulity. The company that competed for this is presumably pretty happy to get it. And my guess is they're going to wait till we're ready to sign. In any case, like Mr. Benjamin, I can't believe that staff would imagine that anybody on this board would be prepared to do that on this little notice. That to me is the most amazing thing, that there's even a thought that the board would be willing to sign off on a $765 million deal without an hour for our own staffs and the people who do finance in the jurisdictions we represent that have to pay for this to look for it, to look over the thing. That's what I don't understand. As far as I know, this is perfectly fine. It's probably what we should do. I expect in the end to be happy to vote for it. If all we were doing today was voting to award the contract to the winner, you know, I'd probably be prepared to do that, although I would like to actually see the information on the award. But financing surely takes a little more time, just a little more time, to evaluate properly.
Okay. Mr. Downey, did you have
Second Mr. Zimmerman's views, that a comfort level that I would have would be a little better if we could see the real comparisons and understand them. A couple of questions. Would you anticipate that there would be a protest from any of the other car builders as we move forward?
My expectation is that there would be no protests.
That there will be.
There would be no protests.
No protests.
No protests. Okay. We were pretty transparent with regard to the process. Mm-hmm. We communicated to all of the vendors. We came down to the competitive range over a month ago. We debriefed all those vendors that were not included in competitive range with the exception of one, and it was their choice not to be debriefed until sometime this month. The remaining vendors that were in the competitive range, we will eliminate them, but we can only eliminate them based on recommendation from you.
And the other question I had, it had partly to do with the issue of jobs and content. Are these cars affected by, ruled by federal requirements, Buy America and the like. Yes. I understand that the Dulles cars, at least, are funded as part of an FTA full funding grant agreement. So I'm assuming that that is in place. They would meet Buy America?
Yes. All of the cars will meet Buy America with the exception of the first four.
Right. We will for which we'll need to get a waiver.
Yes, we will seek a Buy America waiver for them.
Thank you.
Okay, we really do need to come to a conclusion, and I think you've heard the concerns of the board, and I'm not certain if that resolution of coming to the approval may occur here, because I think some of the questions may be questions that are more appropriate for executive session. I'm not sure about Mr. Cato.
I just want to respond to the question, do we have time? And the answer is yes.
Go ahead.
And we had a 90-day window on the bid itself, and that would give us sufficient time, as I suspected, to give more detail and more discussion by next month.
Okay. Well, I think that really relieves some of the concerns that are here, and I guess the other question is in coming back with that within that window, are there other discussions that the board needs to have in executive session so that we can then subject this moving forward in that manner? Yeah. Mr. Albert has a question.
Ms. Cato partly answered my question. Solomon. My question was really, what was the deadline for making a decision without disrupting your planned schedule?
I didn't hear the last part of the
What's the deadline for making your decision without disrupting your schedule?
Our procurement has actually been able to negotiate a 90-day window, as Mr. Cato indicated, which I believe was beginning at March 16th. Is that correct, Kevin? Yes. So actually, we really literally have probably until the end of June. However, we would like to actually have another month in order to, because the board has a lot of pressing issues, budget closing, and we have a pretty busy agenda for May and June, but we do have some time.
Mr. Solomon.
Just that during that time, will MATA staff meet with and confer with the jurisdictional staff about the financing? Because it's my understanding that no one, at least MDOT, tried to get some information about this financing option, and no information was disclosed to them before today's presentation. So, I mean, if you expect the state of Maryland to be a partner in financing, then you have to give them information at their request.
I agree totally. We actually did not have the information ready to discuss because it was a pretty closed procurement. However, we do have baked in our pro forma capital plan the numbers, including the milestone payment that we discussed here in the financing plan, and we will be discussing that with the JCC at tomorrow's meeting. So.
Okay. I think Mr. Benjamin has another question, and then we'll talk about how to move forward.
I just want to make sure I understand some of the technical stuff above and beyond the financial and the approval process. We are talking here about four-car consists as opposed to two-car consists. Is that right?
Yes. The rail cars would be considered as a quad. But we will be able to split the four cars independent of each other. We did that by design so that way we could use our existing shops and lifts, so that way we could match up different two cars between each other. And looking forward, you know, these cars will be predominantly, you know, eight-car trains.
So what you're saying is that if we want, yeah, so we're constrained here to either four-car trains or eight-car trains, but we can't do sixes with this set of equipment. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. So that is one of the constraints that we have with this. And will these be in any way compatible with our existing equipment so that you could mix and match with our existing equipment?
In normal revenue operations, they will not be compatible because of the different platform. But in case of emergency, say, for instance, if we had a consist that was made up of 6,000 series that went down and it needed to be retrieved by one of these 7,000s, we could couple up to it, charge it up with air, and be able to move it back in an emergency, what we would view kind of like an emergency situation. But normal revenue operations, we would not be mixing this equipment.
So what you're saying is we're now doing something that is going to constrain our operations as these start to come in until there's a substantial number of them here.
Yes, right? There would be a transitional period, yes.
Yeah, and so like the first 64 cars, when they're up and operating, they're going to go on one line. They're not going to get spread all over the place in all probability, because that's the only way you can really effectively make sure that they work.
Well,
yes
these,
or no?
These rail cars have the ability to run on any alignment that we have.
I understand, but from an operational point of view, are you going to scatter them all over the place, or you're likely to just run them on one line so that you can do substitutions and things like that?
If for us, you know, per schedule standpoint, we would look at it that if we needed 8-car trains, you know, we would deploy these wherever we would run 8-car trains.
Okay, so you would spread them all over the system?
Absolutely.
Okay, and you would intersperse them, but they wouldn't be together with other cars. So it limits our flexibility, but doesn't make it really, really terrible. Do we have to make decisions at this point about the interior configuration as you do this negotiation, or is that something that, again, waits?
We have options, as we previously discussed, about, you know, seating configurations in the presentation. There is renderings of the traditional seating. We also put in views of where we put everything up against the wall. So that was our biggest flexibility. So there is room.
When do we make that decision?
When do we have to make the decision?
Do we ever have to make a decision which we want, or can you move the seats around whenever you want, even after they're built?
Okay, for example, the way we approach this, traditional seating as is what we see. Let me see what page it is.
Well, let me ask the question differently. If this was subject to moving this forward, do we have to say now what the seating is going to be or what our preferences are? I think some of us, well, I won't say that, but in any case,
yeah.
Or is there a later time frame to do that?
If I could, please go to page 39. Mm-hmm. 39, please. There should be another slide in there that has a different configuration.
Yeah, that's 40.
Where's 39? Okay, 39. There we go. This is the traditional seating configuration right in here. This is what we would originally, you know, propose at this point in time. Now please go to page 40. If we were directed, you know, say for instance in the interim to change, I don't know, a year from now or 2 years from now, all that we would really have to do is change out the bracketing and we would just move the seats around. The integration to transfer from one design to the next has already been thought through. And that's why whenever we looked at the strength of the structural side, we accounted for this configuration. We accounted for the other transverse configuration. Somebody came up and said that we don't want any seats in a rail car. We have thought about that where we would put in beauty plugs and it'd be 100% access. So the flexibility in this is it's very transparent.
So, Mr. Kubitschek, what you're saying is at this point that decision does not have to be made. As a matter of fact, it can be made after they're in operation.
That's correct. We're providing the flexibility as we, you know, move forward.
Okay, so the seating decision is a non-decision. We don't have to worry about it. But at some point in the future, as we see what our loads are, we've got the flexibility to do it either way or even take all seats out or have some sets of seats missing, and you can put them in and take them out, and that's one of the attractive things of this particular design.
Absolutely. That, okay. With us not having the seat wells and everything else, it gives us an open platform at any time or of the life cycle of the car.
And just to follow through on one of the questions that I thought I heard answered, but to make sure that we understand this as we move forward. Although the evaluation was done on the full set of cars to be purchased, in fact, each option stands alone, and we don't, by entering into this contract, in any way, shape, or form, indicate that we will exercise any future options or have any financial burden associated with not exercising future options.
That's correct. That's the way it was negotiated.
Okay, so this is each one we can decide as we go. So if after 364 cars we decide we really don't like these things, as Mr. Downey pointed out, we could then go to somebody else and there would be no, or we could recompete, and there would be no downside financial risk?
None.
Okay.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Alp.
Mr. Jack, what analysis goes into deciding on the configuration of the seats in particular? Specifically, do you get feedback from the riding public in making that decision?
Yes, if you're aware, we did do some seating configurations with the existing existing fleet, where we put some seats transverse, we put some lean-to materials. There's also been studies done where we've had renderings where people were, say, for instance, traditionally seating, and then we would profile where your legs and your feet and stuff would come out. We've also filmed, you know, for example, how people responded inside of rail cars as well.
But it's all theoretical at this point.
Well, the seating configurations we actually had running in a revenue service, and we did have, I think about a year and a half or 2 years ago, we did have a demonstration at the Reagan Airport where we invited the media and board members and everybody else to take a look. So that was part of the evaluation. And we did that in preparation, knowing that we were working on the 7K, and that's where we came to the conclusion that we really needed to have an interior that was very, very flexible. But it would first need to be very robust to support whatever we wanted to try to configure in there as we advanced.
Thank you.
And you've had riders, advisory council, and other participants in this, is that?
We actually had,
at
the rider advisory committee, whenever we were out there at the platform, they actually were there physically as well.
Right.
Madam Chairman, just to address that, because to Mr. Albert's question, in fact, there were hundreds of hours, I believe, of actual use with that were filmed and then analyzed. And I don't know to what degree we ever really got all the results of that, but several different configurations were put into revenue service. The cars were outfitted with cameras so they could track the flow of passengers to evaluate things, such as not only the actual load that you get in real service, but how people flow on and off the cars. And it seems to me that data will be important when we do get to the point, whenever that is, of figuring out which configuration we need or in what mix we may need different configurations for the fleet we will have in the future. Also, it would help just to be able to see, Madam Chairman, in the, you know, the kind of slide we have with that's up there and the other one, actual capacity. All this shows is the difference in the number of seats in the two. It does not show what the capacity is when you fill the car with people.
Okay. Thank you. And if I could also add that with this 7K platform, we will have a closed-circuit TV in all of these rail cars, so that would be the other thing that will be a big benefit for us, is that we'll actually have real-time filming on everything across the board that we could really collect information as we try different things.
Well, are there any other questions at this point? Mr. Kubitschek, I think where we are with this is that I know there are a couple of other pieces here relative to configuration and the serviceability of the cars that I think is important, because I think the other part that we have not talked about, just the brief configuration, is what it brings to a new, to a customer delivering the effect of the customer and the benefits to the customer, because this is a totally different technology that they experience today. But I think we can talk about that briefly when we come back. And I think if it's the consensus of the board, it's that we reschedule this for an executive session for approval, discussion of the questions that need to be raised in executive session, and then into the jurisdictions for evaluation of the financing, and then subject to approval by the board. Mr. Downey, do you have a question?
Another question about the process that led to the design. This may have been discussed before, but in addition to how it functions for the passengers, there's also the issue of how it functions for the operators. Mm-hmm. Were there operators involved in review of the layout of the cab and the control processes and the like, or will we hear that this won't work from their standpoint?
Absolutely. We do have slides, for example, on, you know, page 42 of the interior design and different layouts of the cabs. And the other component of this is that they will continue to be part of the, you know, input into this overall design, because, as you know, you go through first article configuration design, we'll bring out operators so that way that they can sit in and really, you know, critique that firsthand versus just something showing up.
Very important that we do.
Absolutely.
I've seen an air traffic control system that costs billions of dollars not go into service because controllers said that won't work.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Any other questions?
Ms. Hutchinson,
yes,
I just wanted to suggest that we can actually provide the information on the selection criteria that you requested for the April 8th executive session.
Okay. Any other information? Okay. Thank you very much for the presentation. This is a very good news piece. I think it's unfortunate the timing in which we're working on this. I think it's important that the answers to all of the questions regarding the finance gets vetted appropriately. It's an opportunity, though, for us to look at a change of how rail cars will be serving us in terms of safety as well as to the convenience and workability for our customers as well.
At this point, there is no executive session scheduled for April 8th, so either this would have to wait until 2 weeks later or we could entertain a motion at this point for an executive session of the board on April 8th.
May I ask a question? Because I don't think we need to create then executive session for the 8th, and we could bring it back at the next scheduled board meeting.
That would be fine.
And okay. And that would be a much more appropriate time.
Okay.
There isn't anything. Mm-hmm. All righty. If there's no other business here in the Finance Committee, I'd say we are adjourned.